So it's this idea of gratification of very long-term efforts. I've just always been drawn to those kind of things.
That was Tyler Andrews, professional runner for Hoka One One and co-director of Strive Trips, and this is the Running on Ohm podcast. I'm your host, Julia Hanlon, and I want to tell you about a partnership Running on Ohm has. It's with Inside Tracker. So what's even Inside Tracker? It's a personalized health analytics company that gives you nutrition and lifestyle recommendations tailored to your body and life based on a thorough analysis of your blood and physiological data. How cool is that? So Inside Tracker has numerous different plans of varying specificity that will give you simple and sustainable nutrition and lifestyle recommendations to follow. Maybe you're looking to improve your athletic performance, or perhaps you're having trouble sleeping and want to understand how your biomarkers can unlock deeper rest. Inside Tracker is a cutting-edge company that has these answers for you. I have a pretty awesome deal for you guys. You can receive 10% off any Inside Tracker plan by using the full name of this podcast at insidetracker.com checkout. Now, on to our show. Hey everyone, if this is your first time tuning into Running On, welcome. I'm your host, Julia Hanlon, and if this is your 153rd time, welcome back. Running On Ohm is more than just a podcast about running and yoga. It's conversations with wellness pioneers who explore the mind-body connection through different mediums, from actors, meditators, musicians, authors, Olympic gold medalists, chefs to surfers. I believe that the stories of the people that I bring on for all of you every week can change your life. And over the past 2 years, I flirted with one podcast a week, publishing two, and then during one crazy week of Rue Rises, I published 7 podcasts in 7 days, which I definitely don't recommend doing. But I'm returning to 2 podcasts a week regularly, and some of you may not even realize, but it can take me up to 10 hours to prepare the podcast for your listening experience. I'm really committed to giving you all the most professional, authentic, and incredible guests every week, twice a week, but I also need your help in spreading the word about Running On Ohm. Tell a friend, share it on your social media, leave a review. Anything you can do to help me grow this podcast together counts. This conversation with Tyler has been a long time coming. Tyler and I actually went to high school together, and although we didn't know one another in high school, our paths have crossed afterwards through the sport of running and our love of it. Tyler is currently coached by John Waldron, his high school coach, who I had the honor of being an assistant coach to last year. Small world. And Tyler will tell you that in high school, no one would have predicted him to go on to become a 2:16 marathoner and qualify for the Olympic trials. He shares about the path of long-term gratification that's led him to be at the elite level he's at today, where he's sponsored by Hoka One One, plans to represent the U.S. at the 50K World Championships in Doha this December, and then the U.S. Olympic Marathon Trials in 2016. Tyler regularly logs 140 miles a week, and for some of you this may sound crazy, but for Tyler it isn't. He explains that he's built up to this mileage over many years of consistent training, and what keeps him motivated as he trains alone, and how service work is actually a central part of his relationship to running. Tyler is the co-director of Strive Trips, an organization that takes high schoolers to Peru and Kenya to engage in community service while doing endurance training during the summer. Now, how cool is that? Don't you wish you could have done that in high school? Well, if you're a high school runner and tuning in, you can. I would definitely recommend checking out strivetrips.org to see the amazing opportunities they have for summer 2016, and you'll actually get to run with Tyler himself. This conversation gets at the heart of running as an experience of developing one's unique strengths, and why running is in fact a long-term life process that has so many lessons for those who invest their time and heart in it. Now, before we get into today's conversation with Tyler, I have an October giveaway to tell you about. You can win a free swag bag of Nutso. So what's Nutso? Well, it's the only 7-nut and seed butter on the planet. So how do you win Nutso? Get a free swag bag of Nutso jars, hat, and shirt? It's actually really simple. All you have to do is leave Running On Ohm review on the iTunes store, send a screenshot of your review to runningonohm@gmail.com or tweet it to @runningonohm. The giveaway ends October 31st and the winner will be randomly chosen and announced by November 2nd, 2015. Thank you all for listening to this long intro. Thank you for supporting the show. Thank you for reaching out to me on social media. I always love to hear from all of you, and let's dig in together to today's conversation with Tyler Andrews. Yeah, I feel like this is a long time coming.
I know, me too.
It could both be like a long time coming of like years, and then also like just the months of us trying to set this up for us to be in the same room.
It's true.
To dive in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cool that we both went to high school together.
Yep.
But I didn't know you in high school at all.
Yeah. And that's true. Wait, how many years behind me were you?
Two years.
2 years?
Yeah, because you're in my brother's class.
Okay.
But it's amazing how, like, high school, in one sense, is so far away, but also relatively not actually that far away in the scheme of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of growth you've had in your running, in your life, in your purpose, your mission on this earth is so cool. And I think what's amazing, I don't think you would have ever thought in high school you would be doing this now.
Yeah, definitely not. Definitely not before senior year, and even senior year, I think it would have been... I never would have thought that this is where I would be. This is what I would be doing, and this is the kind of person I would be.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine you would have always... When you catch the running bug, I mean, there's no going back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So, like, when you become really passionate about the sport, and as you are someone who loves geeking out on, like, the science of it, I feel like you must have known senior year, like, this is, you know, this is now a lifelong path for me. But to be a 2:16 marathoner... is not really something I feel like with what you had done in high school would have been something anyone would have said, yeah, Tyler's headed there.
Yeah, it's funny because I did definitely catch the running bug senior year. Thanks a big part to John Waldron, who was both of our high school coach and still coaches and coaches at CA and coaches me now professionally. And it's funny, in retrospect, it makes total sense to say, oh yeah, well, nobody saw that coming. No one would have thought that this 1830 5K runner could ever could qualify for the Olympic trials or anything like that. But to me, I was so new to the sport and I was so naive that I didn't really make that connection. I always, like, because John always instilled this idea about you just have to keep training and then you'll keep getting better, which was kind of the opposite of the idea that I had about running before that, which was, some kids are good at running and some kids are not good at running, and I'm not good at running. For me, there was no sense of, like, you can train and get a lot better over a long time. And John really instilled that in me. And so I thought I can qualify for Olympic trials. Why not? I just need to work for a while and it might take a long time. And I can run in college. Sure, I can do that. You know, I remember, like, looking at times and it was like, okay, I need to run whatever, like, sub 16 in the 5K or something. And even that, for someone who's running 1830 as a high schooler, it's like, that's a pretty big jump. But for me, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll just need to do that. There's no sense of, like, oh my God, that's impossible for this
person.
Yeah,
I love that it wasn't impossible. But it was
kind of just me being, you know, out of that normal paradigm. Like, I feel like a lot of kids often get discouraged because there is this sense of, like, you know, okay, if you don't show immediate potential, then you're not gonna
good
be
well in our society. Yeah. Not just in running, I think that is something, like, this instant gratification
mm-hmm.
ethos in our society is that it's like, if you're not, like, the first kid to raise your hand in math class, then you're not good at math.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's become something we becomes ingrained in us. And what's so cool to me about you is, with running, is, like, you had a love for it, but you also had a work ethic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you see, I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy too, because you see people who, a lot of the people at the top were really good when they were younger.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a false correlation. I think it's because those are the people who get encouraged. And I don't necessarily think that there aren't other people like me who could have just, they take a much longer time to develop. But I think that a lot of people don't get the encouragement that I got when I was 17, 18 years old, that, like, oh, you can keep training, keep getting better. A lot of kids will get to freshman year of college and they won't be fast enough to make the team. And they'll say, okay, well, that was fun, but now I'm not going to run anymore. Maybe I'll run a marathon when I'm 40 or something, but I'm not, you know, I can't be competitive anymore. So I'm just going to stop. And for me, because I had this idea of, I just want to keep getting better relative to myself, it didn't really matter what external forces were saying about me. I always just thought, well, I'm better than I was last year, so that's good. Like, I'll just keep doing this, you know?
I love that. It's so inspiring. And as you touched upon, a big part of that voice in your head was actually your coach and mm-hmm. his belief and his belief system that allowed you to see that potential in yourself. Will you talk to me a little bit about the first time you ever met John? Can you remember that memory?
I don't know. Let me think about that. I guess I can talk a little bit about the context of that time period. So going into senior year of high school, I would never have thought of myself as an athlete. Cross country was a sport that I had done earlier in high school, but it was for an athletic requirement because I wasn't coordinated enough to play soccer or anything. And it was something that was like, okay, I have to go to cross country practice at 3:30 and then I can go hang out with my friends afterwards. And like, it's just like another class basically that I have to slog through or something. And that's kind of how I still looked at it at the beginning of senior year. And I really thought that I was going to be a musician. I loved music. I played in a million bands and different instruments and stuff. And that was like my thing. I was like Tyler, the music person. Like everyone knew me as that. And I don't think that there was like this like aha moment of, you know, I met John and my life changed. It wasn't like that at all. It was, I actually remember not liking the new environment because John was a new coach, and I remember not liking the way that the team was being run at first. But and the reason for that was because this was the first time ever that he was splitting up the girls and boys teams. You weren't there for.
Nope, I wasn't coached by John actually.
Yeah, CA. So this was the first time. Up until this point, we had a different coach, and he had always run the cross-country teams as one unit. And so the boys would run with the girls, we'd all do our warm-ups together, we'd all do stretches together, we were coached by the same person. And for me, it was like I said, it was more of like a social engagement than like, oh, I want to go be a good runner for the first couple years I did it. And so I was like, oh, this is annoying, like we don't get to hang out with the girls anymore, you know, I was a 17-year-old boy. And so that was kind of my first impression, was like, this guy, I don't know who this guy is. He's coming in, he's doing things differently, he's splitting us up from the girls. I don't like this. And I really don't know what changed, but somewhere in those first, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of the season, I just started to notice that people started to hang around after practice and talk to John. And this is probably something that you saw, you were assistant coach with him, is that...
He is magical.
He's the kind of person that just, he will stand after practice and talk to whoever wants to talk to him for as long as that person wants to talk to him. And it doesn't matter if they're the slowest person on the team, doesn't matter if they're the fastest person on the team, doesn't matter if he has been standing in the dark for an hour and wants to go home and have dinner with his wife, you know? He does that. And that, I noticed that, and I think I just started being a part of those conversations. And so he and I began to talk more. And meanwhile, for the first time ever, the training that we were doing, if like very, very, very basic training, which was mostly just running a little bit every day, or not even every day, maybe 5 or 6 days a week, I started to run faster in races. And I'm a naturally very competitive person. And suddenly I was like, whoa, this is exciting. Like all of a sudden I was, you know, for our league and our team, I was in the scoring places. And that, to me, it was kind of that combination of like, oh my gosh, like I think I'm actually kind of good at this, which again, at the time, like for someone looking in, like knowing a lot about high school running, it's like, okay, this kid's running 19 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever, nothing spectacular. But for me at the time, it was such a big improvement from what I'd run before. And in our league, like that was fine.
It's so empowering.
That I was like, wow, this is really cool. And so I think it was just like this kind of perfect storm of like all these things happening. Like it was my senior year. A lot of my friends had graduated. I kind of had this like hole that I was looking to fill of, you know, I don't know what I want to do. And I'm like a really passionate person, but I like don't know where to like put all this energy. And then John came along and then I started getting better, and it just all kind of like meshed together. And then suddenly I was like, whoa, okay, I like really care about this all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think it's spectacular because as an assistant coach with John, I've totally witnessed that of being with him. And, you know, he's after practice like 90 minutes later and people are still talking to him. He has this ability to, I think, make each person feel as if they're really the only person in the world when you're talking to him.
It's true.
It's such a gift.
Yeah.
And he has a way of as you said, whether you're the fastest or the slowest runner on the team, your running to him is just as important.
Yep. Yep. 100%.
And you are just as a valuable runner in his eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think that's, yeah, such a gift that both me and you have had the mm-hmm. opportunity to witness.
And I think he recognizes that, and maybe even more so now after, you know, he and I have been working together for 8 years now, because I probably wasn't someone that like would be on like a normal coach's radar in terms of like, oh, this is a kid who has potential. And so I feel like I'm almost like a cautionary tale of like, well, this is what you can miss if you aren't paying attention to every single person on your team. Like, you could have someone who's kind of a sleeper back there somewhere that you just need to like light the fire under them and get them going.
Yeah. And so when you say John and you work together now, how mm-hmm. does that like actually the logistics of that work in your training?
Sure. So I'm based just outside of DC right now. I've been there for about 10 months. And John is up here coaching at Concord Academy still. And we've had kind of an interesting relationship for a long time, really since I graduated, because I took a year off from school between high school and college, and then freshman year I was at a school that Skidmore College that didn't have a cross country or track team. So for those 2 years, John and I kind of actually did something pretty similar to what we're doing now, which is we basically stayed in pretty close touch, but over long distance. So I would, you know, email him and say, John, what workouts should I be doing now? And like, what kind of mileage should I be doing? And he would send me workouts. I'd go run them by myself. And then I'd send him some kind of report and say like, here's what I ran. And, you know, it kind of progressed like that. Now it's gotten to the point that it's more like a conversation. So I'll say, you know, at the beginning of the season, we'll kind of drop a super rough calendar of like, these are the races we want to run. You know, this is the basic kind of mileage and shape that we want to be in at these times. And then, you know, we'll talk on the phone like once a week, and we'll email a bunch during the week. And I'll say, you know, hey, like, we have this workout coming up. Like, what do you think about this? And usually he'll say something like, gosh, that seems like way too much. Why don't you do this instead? And so it's very much kind of a back and forth, right? Yeah, it's like an open thing. It's, you know, I'll say, I'm thinking about doing this run, and he'll say, let's do this, but let's modify it slightly so that it's serving this purpose. And, you know, it's very much, it's always a learning experience for both of us. That's like a huge part is, you know, if we say, you know, okay, I have to run a 50K and it's going to be 75 degrees and it's going to be a bunch of hairpin turns, how do we train for that? You know, like that, like every season we're finding little things that work, and we're finding little things that are problematic and getting rid of those and focusing on the things that work.
Yeah, there's a word, co-creation, and it sounds mm-hmm. like that's what you guys do together. It doesn't feel like John's just giving you the workouts.
Yeah,
it's definitely. This co-creation, it's this co-coaching process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would definitely not, I'm not self-coached. I wouldn't say that. I don't. I rely on him a ton as, you know, a sounding board, as someone who kind of keeps me in check, because I definitely have a tendency to push myself too far if I'm not like, don't have someone kind of holding the reins a little bit. And you know, he's just got so much experience and so much wisdom from all the years that he's been coaching that I'm, you know, I'm super grateful to have him on my team. But it definitely is a conversation, you know. It's funny because I always say we whenever I talk about like a workout or a race or something, you know, like there's a race this weekend. I was like, yeah, like, you know, we said that we wanted to like come through the half in like 110, 111. That's exactly what we did.
So, yeah. And like, that's just so natural.
Yeah,
for you.
It is.
It's not like you're trying to no. say we. It's like you think about you and him as creating this,
yeah,
this
exactly.
experience and this journey together.
Yeah.
Yeah, he should be here.
No, we should have him.
I want to get him on the podcast, definitely. I mean,
I'm surprised you haven't. Wow.
He has some of the best stories mm-hmm. around.
Definitely.
And so where were you this weekend? What'd you do?
Yeah, sure. So we can talk about that. So I ran the Hartford Marathon down in Hartford, Connecticut. It was a relatively late decision to do. It's a race that I was a part of last year. In the half marathon, and we we were thinking about kind of options for the fall, looking at kind of how to structure things. So the big targets for this season are the US Olympic trials for marathon in February and the World Championships for 50K in December. And I wanted to run a marathon at some point in my build up, which I've done before, not like a 100%, you know, all out tapered effort, but mostly just, you know, as a way to go out and have a supported hard long run, where, you know, I have the opportunity to make some money, to travel up here, have family up here. It seemed like the stars kind of aligned, well for this. I felt like I was in really good shape. I did a 35K run about maybe 2 weeks before this, and that was really the one that was
so
like...
So for people who don't do kilometers, because you're a big kilometers guy, what is 35K?
It's just under 22 miles.
Okay, cool.
So I'd done a 22-mile long run at about 2:22 marathon pace, and I said, okay, I'm pretty sure I can run around 2:22, which is the pace that I want to run for 50K, and I knew that would generally place me pretty well at Hartford. So I said, okay, let's go. We'll do it. And yeah, it went really, really well. Like I said before, the goal was kind of to go out conservatively at around 50K race pace. So like 110, 111 for the first half marathon, and then spend the second half, kind of just chasing guys down. And it really, I don't usually say this, but it went almost as well, like as I could have expected. I'm usually super critical of myself, but I was really, really pleased with how it went. It was definitely tough to watch a pack of like 8 guys run away from me and just be like, okay, I'm just doing my own thing. So I basically ran the entire race on my own in no man's land. Yep. But you know, I was 8th at the half and 3rd at the finish. So it was a fun second half, just chasing people down. And, there's definitely that, you know, you have it in the back of your mind that's like, okay, like I know that some of these guys are going to fall off and I'm going to catch them. But at the time when you're like a mile or 2 miles into the marathon and you see like, okay, there's the pack, I could be running with them or I'm going to be running by myself for 25 miles. It's like part of you wants to just like, oh, I just want to go tuck in there. But you know,
so how do you stay motivated during those 25 miles? Because people are listening to this podcast, mm-hmm. whether they're like you, an Olympic trials, you know, qualifier, or just, you know, as someone who wants to just complete a local 5K, like, mm-hmm. some people find it really hard to source that motivation by mm-hmm. themselves. And you do primarily most of your training on your own.
Yep.
And in a race setting like that, where you're riding the edge, you're mm-hmm. you're running at the edge or mm-hmm. close to it. What kept you focused during Hartford?
It's hard. It's a hard question. Like you said, I do a lot of training on my own, so I kind of have practice. And it was funny because there were a couple times where during this race, it was actually on a bike path alongside the Connecticut River, which I do almost all my training on a bike path alongside the Potomac River. And I couldn't see anyone in front of me. There were no spectators. And I was like, oh, I'm just out here doing another workout by myself, you know? So for me, it's very much a situation like that. I just try to say, you know, okay, I'm used to this. I can do this. It's another training run. I've done this a million times. I'm just out here on my own, like pounding away the miles. So I think the bigger question is what, you know, how do you get the motivation to do the training? You know, like the race is exciting at the end of the day for most people. Like you get to travel to some place and there's 50,000 people around and, you know, there are people with cowbells and, you know, whatever. That part is cool. The hard part is putting in the training for the 5 or 6 months or however long, you know, 8 years or 20 years or whatever that you've put in to get to that point. And I don't have a great answer for how to do that. I think that for me, it's the same motivation that I had when I was 17, which is I just want to get better and I want to see what I can get out of myself and out of my body. That's something that was instilled in me as a teenager, and it's something that I still feel really strongly about, especially now that I've gotten better over the last few years. And I want to see what I can do with myself. And I still don't feel like I've reached my potential. I still feel like I have a good ways to go, and I'm like in the middle of this journey. And it's really, really exciting. So for me, every single run that I go do, whether I'm really excited about it or whether it's, you know, oh my gosh, I'm so tired, I don't want to do my run today. Every time it's like, okay, but this is the tiny little piece in this giant, you know, structure that I've been constructing for years and that, you know, I think still has a long ways to go.
Yeah, it definitely is a big puzzle piece or a tapestry that every single run, even if it's that 3 mile shakeout mm-hmm. run, each one has a purpose in your training. You're such an intentional person in what you do. And I find it interesting that you said you were a musician and that was your identity in high school before running was your identity. Mm-hmm. How do you understand like this competitive nature within you? How did it play itself out in music? And then moving to running, I mean, you're speaking of the body and like mm-hmm. getting to the body's limit mm-hmm. and seeing what your body's capable of in running. But when you were in music, like, did it serve that same purpose that running does?
That's a good question. I don't think that my competitive nature was like the dominant force when I was playing music. But I do think that there was a common denominator of I wanted to improve and I wanted to get better and I just wanted to be really good at something. And I felt like I was, you know, again, kind of tracking myself relative to myself.
Being a master of your craft.
Right, exactly. Being a master of my craft, that's a good way to say it. And, you know, whether that was composition or, you know, playing the guitar, playing the saxophone or whatever, I felt very strongly that, you know, it was something where I could see the direct results from the work that I was putting in. And to me, that was really valuable because it is this kind of long-term gratification. Where, you know, you practice for hours and hours and hours and hours, and then you go on stage and you play it for 5 minutes, but you can play it perfectly and you couldn't before. And to me, that was really, really gratifying. That's always been a really gratifying feeling. And I think that carries over perfectly to running, where you say, you know, you go out and you train for 6 months, or even, you know, you could say I've been training for 8 years. And then you go out and you run for an hour or 2 hours or whatever, 4 minutes if you're a miler, or 10 seconds if you're a 100-meter runner, and suddenly you're doing something that's incredible that you've never been able to do before.
It's the culmination of the craft.
So it's this like this idea of gratification of very long-term efforts for me has always been... I've just always been drawn to those kind of things, I think.
And as a creative person from music, how do you feel like your creativity expresses itself in your running?
That's a good question, too. I'm not really sure that it does in my running. I think that, you know, How does my creativity express itself in running? Yeah, I'm not sure that it does. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I do, you know, I like to write, I like to do other things. I do still play music. So I think that that's kind of an outlet for that side of me. I think that running for me isn't necessarily like an artistically creative process. I do think that there's, you know, it definitely serves my scientific mind. It serves my problem-solving mind in terms of thinking about training and physiology and that kind of thing. But I'm not sure if I would say it serves kind of an artistically creative purpose for me.
Yeah, and that's totally cool that you can honor that. Do you ever feel either criticism from people or either self-doubts about yourself of feeling like I'm pursuing something that's so body-centered mm-hmm. that is not as much mind-centered, or does it really have that more mental kind of engagement for you? Because doing so much training by yourself and you log 100 mm-hmm. plus mile weeks, I mean, that's, and this is your job. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you feel like it stimulates your mind?
Yeah, I think it does stimulate my mind. I think that there's a bunch of different ways. I mean, first of all, I have a lot of time where I'm outside running. And I think that can be valuable. I think, you know, some people train with friends or groups, and that's great, and you get a very social kind of aspect. For me, like you said, I do a lot of training on my own. I listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Yeah, David was telling me that.
That's something I picked up once I left college and started training by myself for the most part. So I actually kind of think about that as something that's like, well, you know, if I weren't running, I would get to like read all these great books, which is, you know, kind of a silver lining. But moreover than that, I think is the, like I was just saying, kind of the idea of looking at training from almost a scientific perspective. Because I was a scientist in college, I was an engineer. And I have a very scientific mind, data-driven mind. So to me, that's a huge, huge part of training, is kind of looking at it. You know, it is an art and a science, and I definitely try to look at it from both perspectives. But I have a very hungry mind when it comes to learning about physiology and, you know, exercise science and all kinds of stuff, from both the mental and physical side. So that's something that I've spent a lot of time on, in terms of, you know, just learning about that stuff and how I can apply it to myself and testing things on myself and, you know, developing
hypotheses. Using yourself as the lab. It's so cool.
Yeah, it's funny. John, actually, I was talking at CA on Thursday, and John talked about training as this idea of always being an experiment of one. And I really like that idea. And I feel like that really sums up how we've looked at me forever, basically, which is, you know, we have tried a lot of different things. Some of them have worked well and some of them have not worked well, but we've kind of like done this whole long process of experimenting until we found like, okay, this is basically the kind of training that I respond to and that is going to make me better. And it's not necessarily the type of training that
works for everyone.
I mean, which is really important, because, you know, I was just talking to the whole team and some kid was asking me like, how much do you run every day or something? And I tried to answer that question, and John was like, well, you know, it's important to know that what works for Tyler doesn't necessarily work for you. It's not like Tyler's training isn't necessarily Julia's training or isn't necessarily Matt Donahue's training or whatever, you know? So, and there's so much truth in that, because, and it goes the other way too. Like, there are people who can run a third of the mileage that I do and run way faster than me, you know, in races. And I can't do that. I'm someone who needs a ton of aerobic stimulus. Like, that's
the beast you are.
What I can do. And some people are the other way. They can't, you know, they just can't run that much, or else they get hurt, or, you know, they get beat up or overtrained or whatever. So I think it's really, really important when you look at training to think about that. Like, okay, you're an experiment of one. You can't just like read on Let's Run or Flow Track or whatever and say, okay, like, this is the person that I want to be running. Like I want to be Mary Kane, and so I'm just going to do Mary Kane's training. No, Mary Kane's training works for Mary Kane. And, you know, Dathan Ritzenhine's training works for Dathan Ritzenhine. And you have to find the training that works for you. And
so what does work for you?
What works for me?
Yeah.
For me, I would say,
what's Tyler's secret sauce?
Secret sauce. So the secret sauce is staying healthy. That's no secret. That's always been our number one priority, is get to the starting line healthy, and everything else is secondary. If you can't be healthy, you're not going to run fast. I would a million times over rather be undertrained and healthy than overtrained and hurt, or even well-trained and hurt. And that is something that applies to everybody. That's a universal rule. You cannot function if you can't stay healthy. And so many runners get discouraged because they can't stay healthy, and, you know, they're trying to do something in training that their body doesn't want to do, and they're fighting against their body instead of working with it, and you end up hurt or sick or whatever, and it's no fun. It's demoralizing, it's frustrating, excuse me, and that's how people get turned off from the sport, I think. Beyond that, if you kind of want to talk about like training philosophy, I would say that the big things for us, one is high volume, which we talked a little bit about. I do run a lot. I run twice every day, pretty much. I'll run anywhere from 140 to 160 miles a week during a heavy phase, and a little bit less at the end of the season. That's definitely something big. again, that's something that has been, I didn't always do. It's something that we've progressed towards for the last 8 years, and we've been building that up slowly, 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 slowly. And it was something that I always felt like I responded well to higher mileage. And so every single season it was, well, let's just do a little bit more than last season and a little bit more than last season, until maybe about a year ago, we started doing kind of 150 miles a week. And at that point, it's like, okay, we're starting to feel like it's a point of diminishing returns. Like, we're running a lot. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of energy. I'm not sure that running more is going to continue to make you better. I think that we should hold the mileage and start to do other things differently. Another really important thing is periodization, which basically means doing the training that's appropriate for the time period that you are, that you're in, relative to, you know, a race that you're targeting. So for example, right now I'm training towards the US Olympic trials, which is in February, which is less than 18 weeks out, which is exciting. But it's still, that's like a pretty long ways away. And we generally split kind of into three periods, which we call fundamental, the special period, and the specific period. And each of those kind of has a unique purpose, and each of them is progressing towards the next one. So, you know, if I just tried to hop into a workout 5 weeks out from the marathon right now, I probably wouldn't be able to do it. But the idea, and even on paper, I would say, oh my gosh, like that looks impossible. But the idea is next week's workouts look pretty doable, and 2 weeks workouts look like pretty doable. So the idea is kind of every week, the next week's workouts
you're
look
building,
more and more
building.
Doable. Right. So it's always about building. It's always about knowing what each workout means relative to where you are in the time frame that you're in. And then I think the last kind of important thing that we do is happens in that last 8 or 10 weeks, which is the specific phase, which is just, I would call, specificity in training. So for me, running the marathon the last year and a half now, a big part of that is doing a lot of running at the pace that you want to run for the marathon. And I think that a lot of people, at least in the United States, there's you know, a lot of people will do a very long run, but it'll be very slow. Or they'll do, you know, they'll continue to train like they've trained for other events, like the 10K or the 5K or the half, even the half marathon. So they'll do a track workout and they'll do a long run. Maybe they'll make their track workout a little bit longer and a little bit slower, and they'll make their long run a little bit longer. But they're not really running the pace that they want to run in the marathon. Their track workouts are too fast, their long runs are too slow. So we do a lot of running right at marathon pace, which means, like, I haven't been on a track and I don't even know how long, like 2 years or something, probably.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, which is fine. I was never a crazy track runner. But we'll do, you know, we do a lot of running at that pace, and it's building up to that, right? So again, we do early in the season do very long runs slower, and we do much faster. Like, that's what I'm doing right now, is slow long runs and much faster, shorter intervals. And then, and kind of for the next 6 or 8 weeks, we'll do a little bit faster long runs and a little bit slower and longer intervals. And then we kind of funnel that down to the point that we're really just focusing on marathon pace for the last 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, you're bringing so many questions to mind about your training. But I think one
thing
that's...
I don't want to geek out too much.
No, we can geek out okay. All day. But what I find really cool about your training is you actually post it and you share it online. Mm-hmm. And the way in which you share it is it's a piece of paper that you take a picture of. Mm-hmm. And I've looked at that paper and I see that some of your runs will say NT, which means no time. Mm-hmm. Do you purposely not time your runs mm-hmm. as a part of that kind of recovery?
Yep.
Because if you're running such high volume weeks, you also need to allow your body
yep.
to recover. Mm-hmm. What's your philosophy on the NT?
Yeah, so that actually, if I had to pick one more thing that's like a principle of training, it would be that we focus very, very much on recovery. And that means both in recovery runs and also in terms of like other stuff like nutrition, getting enough sleep, stuff like that.
And the gym work that you do.
And gym work as well. And so for me, I I do not care how fast I run on my non-workout days. And I know even in college, I would often run much slower than my teammates on my recovery days. And then a lot of the time I would sometimes race faster than them. And there was this kind of like dichotomy of like, well, is he just not trying or whatever? But for me, my body has always responded really, really well to this kind of polarized view of you have very hard days where you have a very specific stimulus that you're trying to deliver to the body. And then after that, you know, you're just recovering until the next day. And so for some people that might be no running, or it might be a cross training day. For me, I can run on those days, generally. Sometimes I'm really beat up. But in general, I can run on those days, but I run very, very slowly. You know, given how fast I'm running in my workouts or my races or something, people look at my log and it's like, oh my gosh, this person never runs under 7 minute pace, like on his normal days, which is true. I don't run under 7 minute pace very much.
Love that, because that, I mean, that's really knowing your body.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of, you know, like self-confidence almost. Like it's taken a long time for me to kind of accept that like, okay, this is fine. This is what my body needs. I don't need to go out and run 550 pace every day. You know, I'm like, yeah, there are girls that train faster than me and that's fine. If that works for them, that's great. It doesn't work for me. I can't do that. I can't go out and run, you know, a really hard 20-mile marathon workout and then run 6 minute pace 24 hours later. It just doesn't work.
But do you think that's one of the reasons why you've chosen not to train in a group or with other people?
A little bit. You know, if I could find people who I could train with that, you know, worked with me logistically, I'd love that. And I do sometimes run with other people, just mostly on my normal days. For me, it's mostly like just a logistical problem that there aren't that many people who live down where I do to train with, and I'm pretty tied down to the spot that I am right now. But yeah, I think kind of getting back to your question about the no time, that it definitely is a conscious decision that there are runs where, you know, I know how long all the runs are in my neighborhood, and it's like, it doesn't matter. I don't care how fast this is. I need to go. I know how it needs to feel. And if it feels right and it's 8:30 pace, that's fine. If it feels right and it's 6:30 pace, that's fine. It doesn't matter. I just need to go do it.
I love that. I love that. That's a lot of humility. And you've had some, as you said, you know, you have run really fast and you've had some incredible performances over the past years. Yes. And one of them that I got to witness was the treadmill half marathon record at the Boston Marathon Expo. Wait, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the Boston Marathon Expo.
It was the Boston Marathon Expo.
That feels so long ago.
It does. But
out of all the things you've done, I mean, the 2:16 marathon you run, the 63-minute half, like, what race are you most proud of? And you've run some ultra distances, too.
What race am I most proud of? That's a good question. It's hard to say because, you know, those races are, you know, the 63 minutes and running 2:16 are still very fresh in my mind, and there's still times that I see as, oh, those are, you know, my personal best right now, so those are good. But at the same time, I still kind of have this attitude of like, when I remember running a race and thinking about like, that was an awesome race, I'm thinking about what that meant to me at the time that I ran it. So for example, like I ran the New Bedford Half Marathon in 2010, I think. Yes, I think 2010. And I ran 1:13:03, I think. I still remember that. And that, to me, that was one of the best races I'd ever run, because I was coming off this really disappointing fall. This is my freshman year where I was training by myself at Skidmore. And I had had a bunch of problems with anemia, and I'd had some injuries. I just had like bad race after bad race, and this tough winter in Saratoga, New York, where I was training on my own. And I came down to New Bedford, Mass, and ran this race. And it was one of the few times where I actually ran faster than I thought I would. And that, to me, like, that kind of sums up, like, that's what I feel when I feel like really proud is when I surpass my own expectations, because I set the bar high for myself anyways. And so for me, like, it might sound silly because, like, okay, I just ran like 4 minutes faster than that in the second half of my marathon a couple days ago. But, and, you know, at the time, again, it's all relative to me. So that race at that time was so good for me. And both mentally in terms of where I was and physically, it was just a huge jump. And it really represented like a big step up in terms of what I was capable of at the time. In the same way, you know, I would think about, you know, when I ran my college personal best in the 10K, like something like that. Again, this is a time that I've run faster than in the half marathon now, but at the time it was such a big jump. It was such an unexpected, like, huge improvement that, you know, those are the races that I look back at and say, like, okay,
it's
like
the breakthroughs.
Yeah. It's really like those are the ones that stick out to me.
Yeah, totally. And what, you say you set the bar high for yourself. What is the bar for the Olympic trials for you? Like, when you think about that race, what would be a successful day for you? Maybe, like, what would be the dream? And then maybe what's, like, the B, mm-hmm. A dream, B dream, C dream?
Yeah, it's funny. I think that when I think about the trials, I really think about the 6 months leading up to the trials. It's impossible for me to think about it in isolation. So for me, the biggest goal is to get to the trials knowing that I'm in the best shape of my life. And I feel like that's my goal every season, is to get to the end of the season saying, I'm in the best shape of my life. I've never been able to do the things that I'm doing right now. And for the last 3 seasons, I've been successful in that. So it's been really exciting. So that's my main goal. And I know that's, like, vague and whatever. But when I think about what do I want to do at the trials, I want to say, okay, I want to be able to go out and run a time that I wouldn't have been able to do whatever 8 months ago or a year ago. Specifically in terms of the race, you know, I don't know if there's an easy answer for that. Right now, it's not realistic to think of making an Olympic team for me, and that's not a reasonable, you know, merit for success or failure, because this is the most competitive marathon in the United States, and there's a lot of talent, and I'm still young, and it's, you know, we've always been about pushing ourselves and setting goals, but it's also about realistic goals, right? And realistically, you probably need to run 210 or be in 210 shape to make the team. And am I going to be in 210 shape in February of 2016? I don't think so. I just don't think it's reasonable. It doesn't mean I don't think I can run 210 someday. But it does mean that I think that that's not a reasonable goal for right now. And, you know, there are people who will say, like, oh, you know, you have to, like, be open to anything and you can dream. And sure, like, whatever, anything can happen in the marathon, right? But at the end of the day,
there's also the science that you
have
studied.
To be realistic. So for me, no, it's mostly about getting there, being in PR shape. That's really it. And if that means, you know, if it's 100 degrees and I run 220 and I'm 10th, like, that would be amazing. If it's perfect weather and I run 213 and I'm 40th, that would also be amazing. You know, if it's somewhere
it's working
in between,
with what yeah, the day gives you.
Exactly. Like, the marathon is always like that. You know, I ran 217 in Grandma's. I was this in June of this year, and I was like, it was frustrating because it was a bad day and, you know, we had a headwind and whatever. And at the end of the day, like, it is what it is. Like, I went into that race saying, I'm in the best shape I've ever been in. I can run faster than I've run before. I didn't on race day, but that, to me, that doesn't mean this was a disappointment, you know? So I try not to take, like, one little data point, which is the marathon race, and say, like, okay, this was a success or failure based on that. To me, it's more like, how did this buildup go? Where were you at the end? And, you know, are we still moving in the right direction?
Yeah, it's not having really high attachment to, like, the results, actually. It's, mm-hmm. like, going in, it sounds like, ready to just show up in your highest self that day in the same mm-hmm. way that you let those 8 guys go.
Yeah.
Because you knew that wasn't a part of your plan.
Right. And obviously, yeah, I would love to run really fast and PR and place well. Like, it's not like I'm not competitive with regards to those things. But I need to make sure that
you run within yourself.
Yeah, and that's not my only merit of success. Because if you get married to, like, I need to PR, then especially in the marathon, like, sometimes it's 100 degrees and you're not going to PR if it's 100 degrees. I don't care. You're not going to do it. It doesn't matter if you're in the best shape ever, you know, or if it's pouring rain and windy or something, you're probably not going to run that fast. And in the same way, like, I could say, yeah, I want to be top 10 or top 20. Maybe like 15 guys have like incredible races and it's the deepest trials ever, you know?
Who knows?
I can't control that. All I can control is how I run and how I feel about my race. So that's really how I try to judge whether I'm successful or not.
Yeah, and I think you also, not only in sharing this with me now, but you share this with a lot of the high schooler kids you work with Strive, and that's a huge part of your life. And when you spoke to me about maybe running not necessarily being a creative outlet, I see Strive is actually a pretty creative endeavor because it's like, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interacting with people in a really deep way and in marrying service and running in your life. For listeners who don't know what Strive is, like, what is Strive and what do you do with it?
Sure. So Strive is a program that I started working with back when I was in college. And the idea is basically to combine community service and athletics, which don't necessarily seem like they would go together, but it turns out that they've become a really awesome pair. So the program that I lead is in Peru, and each summer I go down there for a couple months, and groups of kids come, usually from the U.S., for 3 weeks, and the idea is they're there first and foremost to do service work. So a lot of the work that we do is in education. We have our own free after-school programs that we run for local kids. Our Strive kids come down and they volunteer in these programs. And then it's also a space for athletic training. So it's kind of like running camp meets a community service project, and it's all placed up in this beautiful town in the high mountains of Peru. It's something that I've been really passionate about for a while. And it's a really important part of my year. It's one of my favorite parts of the year is going down there and leading these programs. And I think it really goes back to the question that you asked a little while ago about, kind of how do you balance this idea of like being like super body centric and like, I would even call it like self-centric. Like I'm really focused on, you know, me and my PRs and my training and am I getting enough sleep and all of these things. You know, athletics at the end of the day can be very selfish. It's all about like me. And it's kind of an idea of taking that and pairing it with community service, which is really about other people and trying to take energy away from yourself and putting that towards something else. So for me, those two things do pair really well because you're taking something that's really centered around yourself, and it's mixing it with something that's really focused on, you know, the world around you. And I find that our students in general react really well to that. That you get kids who are already really motivated about themselves, and then they can take that energy and put it into a project that's about something, you know, beyond themselves, that's bigger than them.
What for you, out of the years you've done it and in leading it, has been a big breakthrough you've seen in a kid you've worked with? One of the kids who attend Strive that, like, you really, it's either a breakthrough they had when they were at the program or some way in which they've taken what they've done back to their season, back to their community.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for me, I think that a huge part of the program is actually not what happens in the 3 weeks that I'm with each kid, but it's what happens forever beyond that. And I had an experience like that, and that's a big part of why I like doing this. When I, in the year before, between high school and college, I lived in Quito, Ecuador. I've spent a bunch of time there now. And I had never been like on an airplane by myself before at that point. I had never barely been out of the country. And I went to Quito, which is, you know, at that time was, you know, kind of developing as a city. And it was such a transformational experience for me. I just really fell in love with the culture and the people and the language and the mountains and like everything about it. It was so different from where I grew up in rural New England, you know? And to me, that I just, I was so struck by that. I was, and I was also doing service work there, and was really struck by that as well. And that created a lifelong bond now. You know, it was something that then I went back the next summer to visit people I knew. And then at that point, I found out about Strive and was looking, and they were looking for to start a program in South America. And I said, oh my gosh, this is perfect for me. Like, I would love to get involved with this. So this experience for me that was like relatively short, I was only there for a few months during that year, ended up having this huge impact on the direction of my life in terms of, you know, I really fell in love with South America. Then I found Strive. And now, you know, I'm in South America every summer. I'm going back to, I just was in Ecuador last month to run a race and visit some friends. So there's this tiny little seed can really change the way that, that people progress. So that's a very long-winded preface of saying that to me is like the most important thing that I can see happening to a student. So you asked for a specific example. There actually is a kid that kind of had a similar path to me, who was a student maybe 3 or 4 years ago as a high schooler, one of my first years, and just super, super outgoing kid, like totally into everything, like just was like a sponge, wanted to like soak up everything.
And I love kids like that.
Oh, it was awesome. So awesome. And I want to say he was a senior, and then the next summer took a gap year, went back to South America, spent the whole year in Chile, studied at a local school, like was an exchange student there, became fluent in Spanish. Now he's in college studying Spanish. He came back to our program to be a college intern this past summer. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that I love to see that. Because to me, South America means so much and it's so beautiful. And I'd love to see people come down and like catch that same bug, like in the same way that I caught the running bug. You know, it just like it becomes a part of their life and they just want to keep coming down and giving back and learning about the culture and the people and the language. So that's really one of the most rewarding parts for me.
I know you are rooted in DC right now, mm-hmm. but have you ever thought about wanting to live in South America permanently?
So I actually did live there, and I thought it was relatively permanent after I graduated from college. So this actually kind of connects running into all this as well. So when I graduated from college, one of the things that I wanted to do was train pretty seriously. And I didn't really have a good reason for that other than I had some work with Strive that I could kind of do from anywhere. And I felt like I had a bunch of unfulfilled potential in running. And for some reason, I thought that justified that I should go and train for a while. So I said, okay, I'm going to give myself like 6 months or a year. And I'm going to train really hard. And I'm going to run some longer races, half marathon, marathon. I'm going to do training that I think makes a little bit more sense for me than I was doing under my college coach. And so I thought, well, the only problem is I don't really have any money and it's like really expensive to live here. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to move to Quito. It's really cheap there. It's at altitude. I've lived there and know people. I know the language. It's a decent place to train. So I just, I headed down there. I got a part-time job. I was working at a hostel, just like making beds and stuff and like living in the basement of this hostel. I just trained and I did the work for Strive that I had to do. And it was a really crazy, year or so that I was down there. And, it was kind of like one of these weird gambles that ended up paying off well in the end because I got a little bit better and, you know, I had some success in the longer road races and the marathon and then got Hoka's attention and got signed by them. And then, you know, when I was back here, I met the woman who's now my partner and now I'm back in DC. And so like all these like weird moving parts just kind of like flowed perfectly together to bring me back. But, you know, it's definitely, there's another alternate universe where I'm still living in the hostel basement.
That's so great. What was the running culture in Quito like? Like, did you have training partners there? And I've never spent much time in Quito. I've just passed through, but what was like running access like?
So it's funny because I was first there in 2008 and then this was 2013. And even in that short time, I saw so much change in the city, both in general and in the running culture. And they have like kind of a real running boom going on right now. And when I was first there, I did all my training in the park in the center of the city. That's kind of like their central park. And there would maybe be a couple other people out. But now it's just like every weekend there's a road race and there's hundreds of people in the park. They have kind of like in Boston where they shut down Mem Drive. They have a long road that runs the whole north-south length of the city that they shut down every Sunday where people bike and run and stuff. So it suddenly became like such a more pleasant place to be a runner because it was like, okay, instead of just like getting hooted at and stared at all the time, I'm like actually just like a part of this culture that's going on. And it's funny because in terms of training partners, that was actually one of the places where I did run more with other people. I ran, there's the, oh my gosh, what's it called? I actually can't remember the name of the team, but it was basically their national team that I trained with a bunch, which was awesome because a lot of those guys were a lot better than me. Marathon and half marathon 10K guys, and especially because Quito is so high up, it's over 9,000 feet. These are all guys that are from there. They're like super acclimated. Yes. And so they would just like destroy me and everything up there. it was great. You know, I was, you know, I had people to run with, was doing workouts with people. It was a lot of fun. It was a good way to like be really involved in something after college. You know, kind of going from this like super team centric vibe to somewhere where you're totally isolated, I think would have been really difficult for me.
Yeah. To have that really strong community and then in Peru, giving back to that community there. I've been wanting to know, what book are you listening to right now on your runs? I mean, you must go through a lot of books, but
right now I do go through a lot of books. Right now I'm reading Water for Elephants.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but I heard great things.
Yeah, I like it so far. I read a lot of books. I like reading like really long books that like you can really like get immersed in the world, of the book. Like older books like Three Musketeers or The Count of Monte Cristo, stuff like that, or like newer stuff. Like,
would you listen to a book like on a hard workout or
no? So that's I only listen to books on my you know, recovery runs, right?
Okay, I was like, that would be epic.
Yeah, no, like real, like too mellow, I think.
Yeah, way too mellow. Yeah, that'd be really funny.
Well, I do like to listen to books like right before a workout or a race, because I find like it like really keeps me calm and like I have no trouble like getting excited before a race. It's usually the opposite. It's like, okay, I don't want to do anything crazy. This is just another hard effort. So I'm just here listening to my audiobook, like chilling out. And now I'm going to go do my warm up. And okay, now it's time to run. So I feel like that's a good way to kind of keep myself in check.
Yeah. And you have the 50K World Championship. What's the deal with that? Like, why are you choosing to do that before the Olympic trials in February?
Yeah. So it's a good question, a reasonable question. At the beginning of last year, at the beginning of 2015, one of the things that I really wanted to focus on was trying to make a U.S. team, a U.S. national team. And that was something that Hoka, my sponsor, had made it clear was something that would be valuable to them. And it was something that would be valuable just to me as an athlete, as I'm trying to, you know, market myself as someone who's, you know, relevant. I had done up to 45K in training, which is about 28 miles, kind of halfway between the marathon and 50K. It didn't seem that crazy to say, oh, you know, you could probably do this. We can probably train you to run this. And it wouldn't be that different from running a marathon. And so in the spring, in my spring block, we ran again, here we go. In the spring block, we trained me to run the 50K national championship, which was in
Long Island.
Yep.
My good friend who's also was on this podcast, Sarah Bard.
Okay. Yeah, I know her. I've met her.
She won.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, heard it was a hard day.
It was It was actually a terrible day for me. I actually got hurt in that race. I had a minor hamstring tear about 14 kilometers into the 50 kilometer race, and ended up kind of like hobbling all the way to the finish. But the goal there was to make the US team, which somehow I ended up doing. I know, right? So we made the US team, and then it was announced relatively recently, like in August at some point, that the Worlds were going to be in Doha on December 4th, which was a good bit later than they had originally said. Originally, they had said, I think, you know, mid-November. And so we were kind of hesitant, like, is this something we want to do? But, you know, for me, it is a really big deal to represent the USA, to be able to go to a world championship. So we said, yes, we'll do it. And in terms of training, it actually does work out pretty well with what we're doing. You know, kind of like I was describing before, we basically have a funnel kind of projection that we use in terms of starting out. The initial block, which I basically just finished, is, you know, much faster and much slower than marathon pace. And then the middle block is kind of like a little bit slower than marathon pace for longer, and a little bit faster than marathon pace for like longer intervals. So the 50K kind of falls into that second block. And so a lot of the runs that I would be doing in that block are basically long runs at what I've now kind of deemed to be around 50K race pace. So in that sense, it kind of fits into that block relatively well. And I'm someone who has done marathons in my buildup before. You know, I did the 50K last year in my buildup. Obviously that one didn't go well, but you know, I'm not super worried about, you know, needing to take a month off afterwards to recover.
You know, your body can handle that if you have the plan for it.
Exactly. So I know that, you know, unless something goes really wrong, that I should be able to recover from that relatively quickly. And then I have, you know, another 8 or 9 weeks, I think, to the trials, which is, I think, plenty of time for me.
Yeah. So to wrap this up, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground. Yeah. Not actually, we haven't been running, although that'd be cool to do a running podcast. Yeah, on the run. But if you were to kind of leave listeners with a challenge in running, or in the way in which they view their running, what would you say to them?
I think that I would tell people to try to focus on being better as opposed to being good. And it's something that I talked to at Concord Academy about last week, which is, and it's an important distinction, and I think it's kind of a subtle distinction, which is, if you focus on some kind of you know, imposed definition of good, whatever you describe that as, it will always be subjective, and there will always be a time where what you think is good is no longer good, and that will always change. If you focus on just being better, that's something that you can control. You know, better relative to yourself, better relative to last year than 2 years ago, even last month. So for me, that's what I always do. I try, you know, obviously there are external standards and times and whatever that I do care about, but at the same time, I try to focus on, am I better than I was last year, rather than, you know, am I, you know, running well enough to run in college, or am I running well enough to make nationals, or am I running well enough to be an All-American, or am I running well enough to make the Olympic trials? Because like at some point, all of those to me were really good. And now it's like, okay, well, all of those are pretty easy, but now there's all these other times up here that I want to do, but that seem really unreachable, you know? So depending on where you are, I think it makes kind of like setting those bars that are set by, or using those bars that are set by other people, can just end up being really frustrating. But if you just have yourself be the bar, you know, you're always going to be focusing on the right thing.
Be the bar.
Be the bar.
I like it. I think that could be like your tagline.
All right.
Be the bar. I feel like you could make a shirt or something. That'd be kind of cool. And it would be a little esoteric because people would be like, well, are you drinking? Or, you're like, what's the bar? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this was a real honor to get to sit down.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Yeah. And I'm super excited to get to see what's ahead for you in the 50K championship. Thanks. And I'm actually going to be in LA spectating the trials.
Awesome.
So we'll get to yell at you and say, excellent. Be the bar, Tyler.
Awesome.
Good stuff.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Isn't Tyler's perspective, passion, and work ethic really inspiring? I love how his story sheds a different light on what it means to be naturally good at something. Tyler shows us that running is a path of long-term gratification that he's devoted his full self to. I'm really excited to follow Tyler's journey this December, the 50K World Championships in Doha, the Marathon Olympic Trials in February, and beyond. In the same way that Tyler's unlocked what his unique strengths and needs are as an athlete, so can you. Inside Tracker is a personalized health analytics company that gives you nutrition and lifestyle recommendations based on a thorough analysis of your blood and physiological data. Receive 10% off any Inside Tracker plan at any time by using the full name of this podcast at insidetracker.com's checkout. Now, before I sign off for today, two things to share. First, if you want to win a free swag bag of Nutso, the only 7 nut and seed butter on the planet, all you have to do is leave Running On Home a review on the iTunes store, send a screenshot of your review to runningonhome@gmail.com, or tweet it to @runningonhome. The giveaway ends October 31st, and the winner will be randomly chosen and announced by November 2nd. My second ask of you is that you share this podcast with one person. Maybe you tell your running buddy, your best friend, your partner, your mailman, your dog, your cat, who knows? I am committed to giving you guys 2 podcasts a week, and in order to keep this up, I need your help in spreading the word about Rue. Whether it be a tweet, Instagram comment, Facebook post, or email, reach out to me. Let Tyler and I know you tuned in, and share this conversation with just one person who's ready to dig into Tyler's story. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting Running On Ohm. Deep gratitude to each and every one of you. Yes, you. This is your host, Julia Hanlon, and I hope you have a Rue-filled day.